This week, we wrap up our four-part series on the story of Freemasonry. We'll examine the landmarks of Freemasonry, all 25 of them. We'll speculate on where the fraternity truly came from. Was it the Phoenicians? And we'll wrap it up with a sneak peek at a new article coming out, Skinwalker Ranch, Aliens, Two Brothers, and Some Interdimensional Portals. Stay tuned for more.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 461, A Timeline of Freemasonry, Part 4. What will we cover this week? Well, I guess we talked a little bit about that in the bumper before the show. Let's get started with a little bit of news. Ticket sales for MasonicCon Chicago end on September 8th at midnight. That means they are available all day on Monday until 11:59 p.m. We're cutting off ticket sales on that day because we have to have time to ship you your items before the event happens, which will be, again, the 18th, 19th, and 20th. Now, if you're virtual, then you're going to pick up first thing in the morning on the 19th and 20th. But again, if you want to get in on this Masonic education and get all of these awesome benefits, a magazine, the lapel pin, the token, see all of our speakers, exclusive access to those talks for about a year or so. Nobody else can see them until they go public, which is after that. And I'll tell you something else, is Stephen L. Harrison's talk will not be public, so you're going to need to see it live or catch it in the after. And now let's go ahead and dig into the education. So this is Getting Started, part 4 in this series. Each episode has covered a few parts of the paper, but what we're going to cover this week is part 8, the landmarks of Masonry defined and its universality as a secret fraternity. Certain characteristics of Freemasonry called landmarks have long been discussed by Masonic authorities, among whom more or less difference of opinion has arisen. These landmarks are certain unchangeable laws. Dr. Mackey says they are, quote, those peculiar marks of distinction by which we are separated from the profane world and by which we are enabled to designate our inheritance as the sons of light. The universal language and the universal laws of Masonry are landmarks, but not so are the local ceremonies, laws, and usages, which vary in different countries. To attempt to alter or remove these sacred landmarks by which we examine and prove a brother's claims to share in our privileges is one of the most heinous offenses that a Mason can commit. There are, however, certain forms and regulations which, although not constituting landmarks, are nevertheless so protected by the venerable claim of antiquity that they should be guarded by every good Mason with religious care from alteration. It is not in the power of any body of men to make innovation in Masonry. End quote. The real landmarks of the order are thus specified by Dr. Mackey. 1. The modes of recognition. 2. The division of symbolic Masonry into degrees. 3. The legend of the third degree. 4. The government of the fraternity by a presiding officer called a Grand Master who is elected from the body of the craft. 5. The prerogative of the Grand Master to preside over every assembly of the craft wheresoever and whensoever held. 6. The prerogative of the Grand Master to grant dispensations to confer degrees at irregular times. 7. The prerogative of the Grand Master to grant dispensations for opening and holding lodges. 8. The prerogative of the Grand Master to make Masons at sight. 9. The necessity for Masons to congregate in lodges. 10. The government of every lodge by a master and wardens. 11. The necessity that every lodge, when congregated, should be duly tiled. 12. The right of every Mason to be represented in all general meetings of the craft and to instruct his representatives. 13. The right of every Mason to appeal from the decision of his brethren in lodge convened to the Grand Lodge or to the General Assembly of Masons. 14. The right of every Mason to visit and sit in every regular lodge. 15. That no visitor not known to some brother present as a Mason can enter a lodge without undergoing examination. 16. That no lodge can interfere in the business or labor of another lodge. 17. that every Freemason is amenable to the laws and regulations of the Masonic jurisdiction in which he resides, and this although he may not be a member of any lodge. 18. That every candidate for initiation must be a man, freeborn, and of lawful age. 19. That every Mason must believe in the existence of God as the great architect of the universe. 20. That every Mason must believe in a resurrection to a future life. 21. That a book of the law of God must constitute an indispensable part of the furniture of every lodge. 22. That all men in the sight of God are equal and meet in a lodge on one common level. 23. That Freemasonry is a secret society in possession of secrets that cannot be divulged. 24. That Freemasonry consists of a speculative science founded on speculative art. And 25. That the landmarks of Masonry can never be changed. The universality of the landmarks, and of the institution itself, was ably and eloquently set forth by Charles Whittock Moore of Massachusetts in 1856. At the centennial anniversary of St. Andrew's Lodge in Boston, he said, quote, "I suppose it to be entirely true, in view of the great accessions that have been made to its members within the last 2 or 3 years, that there are many persons present who entertain at best but a general and indefinite idea of the antiquity, extent, and magnitude of our institution. And it is equally true that many even of our most intelligent and active young brethren, not having their attention drawn to the subject, overlook its history and extent of its influence, and naturally come to regard it in much the same way that they do the ordinary associations of the day. And this, as naturally, leads to indifference. Masonry, like every other science, whether moral or physical, to be rightly estimated, must be understood in all its relations and conditions. The intelligent Mason values it in the exact ratio that he has investigated its history and studied its philosophy. But my immediate purpose is not to discuss the importance of the study of Masonry as a science, but to show its universality as a fraternity. This will necessarily involve to some extent the history of its rise and progress. In the beginning of the 15th century, Henry VI of England asked of our brethren of that day, where did Masonry begin? And being told that it began in the East, his next inquiry was, who did bring it westerly? And he received for answer that it was brought westerly by the Phoenicians. These answers were predicated not on archaeological investigations, for the archaeology of Masonry had not been opened, but on the traditions of the order, as they had been transmitted from generation to generation and from a period running so far back along the stream of time that it had been lost in the mists and obscurity of the mythological ages. Recent investigations, guided by more certain lights and more extensive and clearer developments of historical truth, have shown that these brethren were not misled by their traditions, and that their answers indicated with remarkable precision what the most learned of our brethren in this country and in Europe at the present time believe to be the true origin of their institution. Freemasonry was originally a fraternity of practical builders, architects, and artificers. This is conceded by all who are to any extent acquainted with the history of its traditions. The Phoenicians, whose capital cities were Tyre and Sidon, were the early patrons of that semi-religious mystic fraternity or society of builders known in the history as the Dionysian Architects. That this fraternity were employed by the Tyrians and Sidonians in the erection of costly temples to unknown deities, in the building of rich and gorgeous palaces, in the strengthening and beautifying their cities, is universally admitted. That they were the cunning workmen sent by Hiram, king of Tyre, to aid King Solomon in the erection of the Temple of Mount Moriah is scarcely less certain. Their presence in that city at that time of the building of the temple is the evidence of history, and Hiram, the widow's son, to whom Solomon entrusted the superintendence of the workmen as an inhabitant of Tyre and as a skilled architect and cunning and curious workman, was doubtless one of their number. Hence we are scarcely claiming too much for our order when we suppose that the Dionysians were sent by Hiram, king of Tyre, to assist King Solomon in the construction of the house he was about to dedicate to Jehovah, and that they communicated to their Jewish fellow laborers a knowledge of the advantages of their fraternity, and invited them to a participation in its mysteries and privileges. These men of Jewish faith were neither architects nor artificers. By Solomon's own admission, they were not even skilled enough in the art of building to cut and prepare the timber in the forests of Lebanon, and hence he was compelled to employ the Sidonians to do that work for him. The Tyrians, says a learned foreign brother, were celebrated artists. Solomon, therefore, unable to find builders of superior skill for the execution of his plans in his own dominions, engaged Tyrians, who, with the assistance of the Jewish men who contented themselves in performing the inferior labors, finished that stupendous edifice. And we are told, on the authority of Josephus, that, quote, "The temple at Jerusalem was built on the same plan, in the same style, and by the same architects as the temple of Hercules and Astarte at Tyre." They were doubtless all three built by one of the companies of Dionysian architects, who at that time were numerous throughout Asia Minor, where they possessed the exclusive privilege of erecting temples, theaters, and other public buildings. Dionysius arrived in Greece from Egypt about 1,500 years before Christ, and there instituted or introduced the Dionysian Mysteries. The iconic migration occurred about 300 years afterwards, or 1,200 years B.C., the emigrants carrying with them from Greece to Asia Minor the mysteries of Dionysius before they had been corrupted by the Athenians. In a short time, says Mr. Laurie, the Asiatic colonies surpassed the mother country in prosperity and science. Sculpture and marble, and the Doric and Ionic orders were the result of their ingenuity. We know, says a learned encyclopedist, that the Dionysiacs of Ionia, which place has, according to Herodotus, always been celebrated for the genius of its inhabitants, were a great corporation of architects and engineers who undertook and even monopolized the building of temples, stadiums, and theaters, precisely as the fraternity of Masons are known to have, in the Middle Ages, monopolized the building of cathedrals and conventional churches. Indeed, the Dionysiacs resembled the mystical fraternity, now called Freemasons, in many important particulars. They allowed no strangers to interfere in their employment, recognized each other by signs and tokens. They professed certain mysterious doctrines under the tuition and tutelage of Bacchus, and they called other men profane because they were not admitted into these mysteries. The testimony of history is that they supplied Ionia and the surrounding country as far as the Hellespont with theatrical apparatus by contract. They also practiced their art in Syria, Persia, and India, and about 300 years before the birth of Christ, a considerable number of them were incorporated by a command of the king, Pergamus, who assigned to them Teos as a settlement. It was this fraternity, whether called Greeks, Tyrians, or Phoenicians, who built the temple at Jerusalem. That stupendous work under God was the result of their genius and scientific skill. And this being true from them, are we a fraternity lineally descended, or our antiquity is a myth and our traditions a fable? Hence the answer of our English brethren of the 15th century to the inquiry of Henry VI that Masonry was brought westerly by the Phoenicians indicated with great accuracy the probable origin of the institution. They might indeed have said to him that, long anterior to the advent of Christianity, the mountains of Judea and the plains of Syria, the deserts of India, and the valley of the Nile were cheered by its presence and enlivened by its song. That more than 1,000 years before the coming of the Son of Man, a little company of cunning workmen from the neighboring city of Tyre were assembled on the pleasant Mount Moriah at the call of the wise King of Israel, and there erected out of their great skill a mighty edifice, whose splendid and unrivaled perfection and whose grandeur and sublimity have been the admiration and theme of all succeeding ages. They might have said to him that this was the craft work of a fraternity to whose genius and discoveries and to whose matchless skills and ability the wisest of men in all ages have bowed with respect. They might also have said to him that, having finished that great work and filled all Judea with temples and places and palaces and walled cities, having enriched and beautified Azer, Gozara, and Palmyra with the results of their genius, these cunning workmen in after times, passing through the Essene associations and finally issuing out of the mystic halls of the Collegia Artificum of Rome, burst upon the dark ages of the world like a bright star peering through a black cloud, and under the patronage of the Church, produced those splendid monuments of genius which set at a defiance the highest attainment of modern art. And if in addition to all this, they had said to him that in the year AD 926, one of his predecessors on the throne of England had invited them from all parts of the continent to meet him in general assembly at his royal city of York, the answer to his inquiry, "Who did bring it westerly?" would have been complete. Henceforward, for 8 centuries, Masonry continued an operative fraternity, producing both in England and on the continent those grand and unapproachable specimens of art, which are the pride of Central Europe and the admiration of the traveler. But it is no longer an operative association. We of this day as Masons set up no pretensions to extraordinary skill in the physical sciences. Very few of us, accomplished Masons as we may be, would willingly undertake to erect another temple on the Mount Moriah. Very certain we are that our own honored, most worshipful Grand Master, primus inter pares, as all his brethren acknowledge him to be, would hesitate a long time before consenting to assume the duties of architect for another Westminster Abbey or a new St. Paul's. At the reorganization of the craft and the establishment of the present Lodge of England in 1717, we laid aside our operative character and with it all pretensions to extraordinary skill in architectural science. We then became a purely moral and benevolent association whose great aim is the development and cultivation of the moral sentiment, the social principle, and the benevolent affections, a higher reverence for God and a warmer love for man. New laws and regulations adapted to the changed condition of the institution were then made. An entire revolution in its governmental policy took place. Order and system obtained where neither had previously existed, and England became the great central point of Masonry for the whole world. From this source have lodges grand and subordinate at various times been established and still exist and flourish. In France and Switzerland, in all the German states save Austria, and there at different times and for short seasons, and up and down the classic shores of the Rhine in Prussia and Holland, Belgium, Saxony, Hanover, Sweden, Denmark, Russia, and even in fallen Poland, in Italy and Spain, under the cover of secrecy, in various parts of Asia, Turkey, Syria, as at Aleppo, where the English Lodge was established more than a century ago, in all the East India settlements, in Bengal, Bombay, Madras, in all of which lodges are numerous, in China, where there is a provincial Grand Master and several lodges, in various parts of Africa, as the Cape of Cod, the Cape of Good Hope, and at Sierra Leone, on the Gambia, and on the Nile. In all the larger islands of the Pacific and Indian Ocean, in Ceylon, Sumatra, St. Helen, Mauritius, Madagascar, in all the principal settlements of Australia, as at Adelaide, Melbourne, Parramatta, Sydney, New Zealand, in Greece, where there is a Grand Lodge, in Algeria, in Tunis, in the Empire of Morocco, and wherever else in the Old World the genius of civilization has obtained a standpoint, or Christianity has erected the banner of the cross. In all the West India islands and the various parts of South America, as in Peru, Venezuela, New Grenada, Guyana, Brazil, Chile, etc., Masonry is prospering as never before. In the latter Republic of the Grand Lodge of this Commonwealth has a flourishing subordinate, and the Grand Master has just authorized the establishment of another lodge there. On our own continent, our order was never more widely diffused or in a more healthy condition. In Mexico, even respectable lodges are maintained, in despite of the opposition of a bigoted priesthood, and in all British America, from Newfoundland through Nova Scotia and the Canadas to the icy regions of the North, Masonic lodges and Masonic brethren may be found to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and bind up the wounds of the afflicted. On the condition of the institution in our own country, I need not dwell. Every state and territory except the unorganized territory of Washington, including even Kansas, has its Grand Lodge, and nearly every considerable town and village its one or more subordinate lodges. If we add to these the large number of chapters, councils, encampments, and other Masonic associations which are spread all over the length and breadth of the land, we have the evidence of a prosperity unparalleled in the annals of any other human institution in any age of the world. Masonry is indeed a universal institution. History does not furnish its parallel. It exists where Christianity has not gone, and its claims will be respected even where the superior claims of religion would fail. It is never obscured by the darkness of night. The eye of day is always upon it. Its footprints are to be traced in the most distant regions and in the remotest ages of the earth. Among all civilized people, its existence is recognized. It came to our shores at an auspicious period, and it was here rocked in the cradle of liberty by Washington, a Franklin, a Hancock, and a Warren. Unaffected by the tempests of war, the storms of persecution, or the denunciations of fanaticism, it still stands proudly erect in the sunshine and clear light of heaven, with not a marble fractured, not a pillar fallen. It still stands like some patriarchal monarch of the forest, with its vigorous roots riveted to the soil, and its broad limbs spread in bold outline against the sky. And in generations yet to come, as in ages past, the sunlight of honor and renown will delight to linger and play amid its venerable branches. And if ever, in the providence of God, lashed by the storm and riven by lightning, it shall totter to its fall, around its trunk will the ivy of filial affection that has so long clasped it still cling and mantle with greenness and verdure its ruin and decay. In no sketch of Masonry, perhaps, should mention of the charities of the order be omitted. Masonic benevolence are well systemized the world over. Some of them are necessarily public, but the greater number are never heard of outside the lodge. It is not the policy of Masonry to disperse benevolence to any but those who actually need them. The order does not, for instance, pay any member a sum of money merely because he is sick. The actual pitch of poverty must be manifest before the coffers of the society are opened. When want stares a Freemason, his widow, or his orphans in the face, they are liberally assisted to tide over their misfortunes. Public Masonic charities take different forms in different countries. In Sweden, 12 work schools in which poor children are taught useful trades are maintained. In Hungary, last winter, a daily average of 9,722 poor people were each given a loaf of bread, and at milk depots, numberless children were given each a roll and a pint of milk during the rigors of the frosty weather. In America, public Masonic charities have largely been in the form of Masonic homes, great institutions in which the aged, widows, and orphans are given a pleasant home because of their connection with the fraternity. A few words in conclusion. It has been the intent of the writer to condense within about 100 pages such a sketch of Freemasonry as would interest men and women and yield to them correct ideas of the order. If a just account has been given of the legend of the tradition of Masonry, of its early manifestations, of the famous attacks upon it, of its teachings, and of its extent, the author's purpose has been accomplished. There has been no attempt to make this little book cyclopedic, monitorial, jurisprudent, disquisitional, argumentative, or speculative. The whole purpose has been to make the story accurate and brief. For those whose minds may not be content with the primary methods adopted herein, there is a literature which will carry them to the highest pinnacles of Masonic learning in a dozen different branches, and to which they may be directed by any informed member of the fraternity. Well, there you have it. The completion. The Story of Freemasonry by W.G. Sibley. What did you guys think? You know, as I read this last portion, I suppose it's no surprise that in 1913, when this was penned, there is an overtly Christian sense about it. I would suppose anywhere it said anywhere in the civilized world would be enough. However, there always comes the secondary, anywhere in the civilized world or where Christendom has taken up the cross. I find that that's probably a slight redundancy, but Nevertheless, saying things like that likely increases the odds of publishing. And of course, I think there were a few parts in this paper which gloss over the idea of charity in a way that is almost dangerous, because we don't want to strictly attach this kind of charity to the idea of benevolent giving, because that really isn't what it's about, even though that's what we have embodied. But nevertheless, a really great paper. I thought it was pretty succinct. You know, his comments at the last bit here, you know, where he's talking about what he was hoping for in this paper, I think he accomplished those things. I particularly enjoyed the bit about the Dionysian artificers, because it gave even more mindfulness centered around the origins of the craft, which we were exposed to 3 or 4 episodes ago when we started this paper. Now, sometimes I take a little bit of liberty and I'll read something that is coming out soon, but to the listeners of the program, you know, you're getting this about 6 hours early, I would suppose, but recently I found myself on an airplane heading to Denver, Colorado, to meet up with Ben Williams. What were we doing? Well, we were going to check out Skinwalker Ranch. So I'd like to read you this quick piece that I wrote called Strange Times: Two Brothers, Aliens, Skinwalkers, and Interdimensional Portals, by Robert H. Johnson. Whether you're a History Channel junkie or just someone who likes the more fringe shows, Ancient Aliens, Oak Island, or Unidentified, you might dig this article. About 5 months ago, I was on the phone with my friend and brother Ben Williams. Ben and I share an affinity for all things strange and unusual. Having come to Freemasonry for philosophy and occult, we both are into some similar stuff. This past year, on the History Channel, a new show started. It was all about Skinwalker Ranch. In short, Skinwalker Ranch is said to be the most paranormal spot on the planet. And if that isn't enough, it's also the one place on Earth that has been examined more than any other, according to storytellers. Billionaire Robert Bigelow had even acquired the ranch in the 1990s and started an organization called the National Institute for Discovery Science, or NIDS. This group studied the land for years, and while they never came away with anything concrete, they sure documented some strange things. What kind of strange things, you might ask? Sasquatch? Aliens? UFOs? Interdimensional portals? Ghosts? And many more. It's like a paranormal buffet. The new show on History Channel documents the most recent attempt to get to the bottom of what goes on at the ranch. The phenomenon, however, is not just tied to the several hundred acres of the ranch. It's connected to the entire Uinta Basin of Utah. Most of the basin in the area in question is owned by a group called Adamantium Holdings, LLC. After a few attempts at trying to contact the owners of the property, Ben and I became only slightly frustrated. We decided to go out to the ranch ourselves. So I got a plane ticket, packed my bags, and Ben and I headed out for a weekend of hiking over the harsh Utah basin, where we encountered bizarre things. We were two brothers on a mission to figure this thing out. And maybe our Masonic knowledge of philosophy and our understanding of the occult would allow us to view these phenomena in a new light. Over 3 days, Ben and I hiked all over the basin. I took about 500 pictures, hours of electromagnetic field readings, hours of radiation readings, and I recorded the whole time in audio. We will be writing a more extensive article for the new publication called The Esoteric Mason, which we'll begin publishing later this year. What will go into that magazine is quite a bit more than I can talk about here, and there will be some links so that you can listen to the audio as we hike 7.5 miles across the Utah Basin. What, however, does Skinwalker Ranch and the paranormal have to do with Freemasonry? Perhaps it's not so much what these things have to do with Freemasonry, but in the unlikely team-up of two brothers from two different states with our own publications and similar interests who would try to get to the bottom of this. I have no problem telling you right now that I believe Ben Williams and myself solved the mystery of the extremely high electromagnetic field readings in the basin. What could we not explain? Ben and I could not explain some of the strange lights we saw in the sky. I couldn't explain some of the shadow people that I saw in a field at dusk. We couldn't explain the piles of animal bones on a section of cliff. More will be revealed in the future, but for now, I want to let you all know that there is something strange afoot out there, something I just can't shake from my head. is the rhythmic and low-frequency hum of the landscape in the dead of night. I hear it when I close my eyes. Keep looking up. So that there is a preview of the article that's coming out Monday morning. So in just a couple hours, if you're listening to this at the time it's being released. That's it for this week. I hope you guys all have an amazing week coming up. Next week, we've got some great education planned as well. Don't forget about MasonicCon Chicago. Get your tickets now because the ticket sales will end on the 8th at midnight. For more information, go to www.masoniccon.chicago.com. Also, I want to invite you to check out The Esoteric Mason. So go to esotericmason.com to get more information about that publication. And I'd like to thank also our producers, our fellows and contributors, without whom we would not be able to do any of this. So if you see somebody out there with a little Whence Came You producer's pin, make sure you thank them, because it's because of them that you get to listen to this program. If you want to learn more about how to support the WCY podcast, head on over to wcypodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out the various options there. And one last thing before I leave you this week. I can't say for what yet, but I just want to say congratulations to Greg Knott. That's it, everybody. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.